Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, here we are back again talking about EB5.
Hello, Mark. Yes, we're not only talking about EB5 today, we're actually talking on a very hot topic, something which is right at the forefront of a lot of people's attention.
And their back pockets, right? Because we're talking about money in this episode.
Right, right. And who better than to talk about such an important topic today than what we call one of the titans of EB5, one of the founding fathers.
That's right, Patrick Hogan. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Well, that's very gracious of you to say that. I don't know if I was a titan other than a survivor, being the fact that I started in 1993, and it took me approximately 16 years to get my first IA-29. Yeah, I guess that's kind of a history.
So let me take this opportunity to introduce you to new listeners. So Patrick Hogan, of course, you've been on the show before about 18 months ago, where you enlightened us about EB-5 project structures. And as you pointed out, you've been doing EB-5 work since 1993, before the Regional Center program. So that's a huge track record. You know, one of the things I want to point out is you've collected nearly $3 billion in EB-5 funds, but you also have matched that with partner funds of about $12 billion. So $12 billion domestic and $3 billion through EB-5. Yeah, that's a lot of money. So when all the questions came up around money, Mona's like, we need to have Patrick Hogan back on. So Patrick, again, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It harkens back to that project structure that you were talking about. That's why we've been able to do it. So $15 billion in economic activity throughout the United States is it's quite an accomplishment, but it's also quite a job to be able to manage all that.
I imagine. And we talked a lot about the tactics in that last episode. And if the person who's listening right now is curious about EB-5 project structures and wants to hear Patrick Hogan's take on that, go back about 18 months in the podcast feed and you'll be able to find that episode on EB-5 project structures. But in this one, we're going to talk about money. And, you know, actually, I want to pull a quote out that Patrick, that you gave us a year and a half ago. And that was, take care of the client and we'll make money. And so here you are back 18 months later, and we're talking about money.
Yeah, well, that's the motto of CMB. We knew that the client was the first thing to take care of. I mean, it's their dream. It's their money. It's how we manage everything. And so we know that if, in fact, we have their interest in the beginning and through the process at heart, that things will work out. And in the end, we'll make money as an entity also.
Pat, so the real topic here today is, yes, money. But it's really just when an investor's capital can be withdrawn from the EB-5 project. This is becoming so, so important for a number of reasons. One being retrogression that's hit Chinese mainland investors and investors who really do come into this program thinking that it's just like an immigration program and they can withdraw at any time without the understanding that every action has a consequential reaction. And we aren't dealing with immigration alone. We're dealing with business. We're dealing with corporate. We're dealing with just a number of different factors. The first thing really is that we really should point out to our listeners, and I hasten to add as well to all my immigration attorney colleagues, don't forget EB-5 is a business. It's a business first. Yes, we get immigration out of it, but it's the business side first. Right, Pat?
It is. And, you know, we're talking about money. So one of the things we will get into is the return of money. But what I'd like to say, too, part of the EB-5 statistics that CMB has accomplished is the return of 11 various partnerships to the individual, all of, you know, their capital investment. So when you look at it, we've returned about $400 million back to the investors who have gone full circle. In other words, from the very beginning, getting their approvals, then getting their 829 and their permanent visa, and then getting return of their capital and the closing of the partnership. So we've accomplished that in 11 various partnerships.
That's really impressive. It's really impressive. But at the same time, with all my years of experience with EB-5, I do understand, Pat, how hard that is. Because any business, it doesn't matter what it is, takes time to establish, takes time to get to the stage where you have the ability to give back.
It does take time. And as a matter of fact, that's part of the topic that we wanted to talk today about, how long that time is. It's ever creeping longer and longer for various countries. It's something that in the very beginning, no one anticipated.
That's right. So really, our starting point should be, well, what does statute and regulation state? And statute and regulation both state that the money must be sustained. So the earliest that money can be withdrawn from a project really is, well, it used to be after the I-829 was approved. However, there was recently a USCIS memo basically understanding that there are long delays with I-829, so allowing an investor to withdraw their money from the project at the time the I-829 is filed. But that's not really the issue here. The issue here are investors who, well before the I-829, decide that they just don't want to be in the project anymore. They don't want to do EB-5 anymore, and they just want their money back, despite the fact that they have signed documents saying their money is contractually contained within a project.
Yes, I mean, there's contractual obligations and there's EB-5 obligations.
Right.
And hopefully your documents reflect that both of those are intertwined. You know, ours do. That's why it's become a very difficult situation when someone just says, okay, I'm tired of the wait, I want my money back. Well, they need to realize that the USCIS, even in escrow, says that the money has to be irrevocably invested. And so how do you get around
that? What does that mean? But what does that actually mean for our listeners who really want to understand, what does irrevocably invested mean? And what does that mean practically, Pat?
Well, from a practical standpoint, from an escrow, people can put money in escrow and they can say, okay, let's wait until I get my I-526 approval. Well, that's okay to do that, but the money has to be in the escrow and it can only be released basically on two conditions. A, that the investor is denied his petition and then he can get his money back. Or B, if it's approved, it will go to the investment and be irrevocably in the investment. It really goes back to, and you start from the very beginning, is what does invest mean? And so invest, according to the memo, let's just go back to the 2013 memo, the policy memorandum put out by the USCIS, and they define that invest means to contribute capital, a contribution of capital in exchange for a note, bond, or convertible debt obligation. That's the invest side. Then you have to look at what the at-risk requirement. And basically, they say the at-risk requirement for the purpose of generating a return and that the mere intent to invest is not sufficient. They go on to say that an alien must show actual commitment of the required amount of capital. In other words, that money has to be committed to the job creating entity or to the NCE, the new commercial enterprise. And it cannot be a debt arrangement or a demand note or something where the person can just demand they're out. The USCIS had said over and over again that the money must be committed to the investment and it must be at risk.
So if we have a developer, and there are plenty of developers who listen to this podcast, one of their clients just said, look, I don't want to be there. I'm only one person. Just let me out. Can that happen?
Well, again, let's go back to what those documents say. So I can speak to similarly to what CMB's documents say. And let me say this, we've never had a project denial. So it's obvious that our project documents have passed muster thousands of times, over 4,000 times with the approvals that we had. So we must be doing it in the correct way. And our documents basically say that our investors have a limited right to withdraw. And that limited right to withdraw is, you know, you want to take care of things that if the person was to die, if in fact the USCIS denied the I-526 for any reason, and usually that's a source of funds, or that there was maybe not truthfulness on behalf of the investor at the I-526. So far with CMB, it's never been because of the project. I have 100% success rate when it comes to project approval. So, you know, if an individual is denied at the I-526, our documents say that, you know, they obviously can get their money back simply because there is no immigration pursuit after that. it's terminated. They can't get an immigration pursuit. Therefore, we're really not subject to the USCIS, and therefore we can give them the money back because we're not going to hurt anything. They're not going to get their immigration pursuit. However, you can't just simply decide to quit. That is something that if you have that in your documents, the USCIS would basically say that that is a redemption agreement,
right,
and that is not allowed.
Right. So a redemption agreement is just, it's prohibited under EB-5, but that is your at-risk element, which means that you cannot be promised or guaranteed your money back. And I feel it's really important to keep on explaining this. We explain to clients all the time because I try to say to them, if there was not a redemption, if you were allowed a redemption agreements and guarantees, then every investor would just invest in IBM and the whole idea of an entrepreneurship would never happen.
Yes, the matter of Azumi, which was a case decided in the 90s, okay, has really been the guiding principle that the USCIS and the immigration lawyers have been following. And under Section 8 CFR 204.6 Part E, you cannot say that there is a redemption agreement. And they basically said in this memo, it was also upheld by the AAO decision, and it's found that the capital was not at risk because the investment was governed by a redemption agreement that protected against the risk of loss,
right,
you know, of the original capital, and therefore constituted an impermissible debt arrangement. So in other words, if an individual had the ability to just say, I want out, the USCIS is going to say, well, he wasn't really an investor. He just loaned the money to the entity and he had a demand note and he could demand his money back at any time. Therefore,
right,
it really wasn't an investment. So the question is how could you structure a document that would allow somebody out that wouldn't fall under that redemption clause? And I don't think you can. And so documents that are usually that I see that are successful in EB-5 are structured such that the investor cannot get out. He basically has to write out the investment.
Right. But there is a limited right of substitution in some cases.
Yes, there is. In some cases, you can get a replacement investor. But that's a very complicated issue in this respect. Remember that it depends on the timing. If, in fact, all job creation has already occurred, that's a touchy issue. And I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole because I'd just be afraid that that investor, there's no way that I could attribute his money to the actual job creation since it already was created. So there is a time frame, if you were on that. You know, the limited right to withdraw, it still keeps that same amount of money within the investment. But at a certain time, you're not going to able ever to find a replacement investor simply because he can never get the immigration benefit because the jobs have already been created.
Right. And if we look at the ordinary laws of contract and just forget it was EB-5, it's not so easy to get out of a contract. You know, there are limited rights to rescind in contract law, but it's not so straightforward.
Well, let's look at the structure just for a second, and let's use a loan model instead of an equity model. But if an individual invests within a new commercial enterprise, which is the limited partnership, and that limited partnership then enters into a contract with a third party to loan that individual the money, let's see, i.e. to build a structure and thereby creating the jobs, how do you rescind a third-party contract so that you can pay that person back who decides he doesn't or she doesn't want to be in it? It's an impossibility. So in a sense, you're asking to rescind two very legal contracts. And I see that as almost an impossible situation.
Well, I have two scenarios that I want to discuss with you, Pat. First of all, what about the situation where the documents say your money has to be there for at least 5 years, and there's just no way within that five-year period either the person is able to get their green card because of retrogression, or the project, because of delays in construction, etc., just isn't able to complete, and say they're having refinance issues or sale issues, they're just not able to get to that situation. So if there's a five-year loan agreement in the documents, would an investor be able to get out in that situation, in that scenario?
Here's what I would say. Again, it's going to be all what the documents say, of course. But remember, what we're talking about is the first contract. That is the contract between the investor and the new commercial enterprise. The investor says, I'm going to invest for a limited partnership share in this particular new commercial enterprise. The problem is the new commercial enterprise has entered into a legal binding contract with a third party. The question is if you rescind that third party contract, does he have the obligation to pay you back in order for the new commercial enterprise to actually to pay back the investor? And I would suspect there's not too many regional centers, including my own, that would be able to pay back on an entire project should it be ruled, say, okay, well, you've got to pay all these investors back. Well, how do I get the third party to rescind their contract and actually pay me back? So I think what you've got is, you know, simply a dominoes theory that the investors, once they're into an EB-5 investment, and they should understand this, once you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
For instance, ours are 6-year contracts, and mostly those were structured that way and from the very beginning because we dealt with government entities and used tax increment financing to pay us back. So we had to allow for that time of the tax increment to come forward. So in the instance of CMB, we have the 6-year project. There is just no way that we could rescind the contract with the third party and have them give us the money back. I mean, they're in the middle of construction. Now, in your case, Mona, let's assume that a project then stalls, as you said. Well, the question would be, if the project stalls, that probably means the third party contractor is in trouble.
Yes.
So the idea of trying to get money from that individual to pay back the loan is probably very difficult. It's probably, you got more problems than paying back the money. You got whether you've got to complete the project in order for the new commercial enterprise to be paid back. So in that case, an investor ought to be very happy to try to work with that developer to make sure the project gets done so that, in fact, they can get paid back. So that's a unique situation that is probably not so unique anymore if, in fact, you know, the EB-5 program was due to just end or whatever. I think that might be something we might see more commonplace than ever.
Well, that leads to my second scenario. And again, I can't stress enough how important it is for investors to really, really see where they're putting their investment. But in a situation where they put it into a project, and most projects just either do not use escrow or have almost immediate release, the money goes into the project and the case gets denied, the investor's case gets denied. There isn't any money to pay the investor back, even though you would say that, okay, we can pay at that stage. I've seen documents where they won't give it back to you at the denial stage.
Well, that goes to the very beginning and reading the documents and understanding the investment that you're getting into. You know, I understand the need for no escrow anymore because there's no way that a company could function in holding money back until the I-526 approval came through with today's adjudication rates. Even if there was no retrogression, 2 years is impossible to try to hold money, hoping that, in fact, it would get there. These projects need certainty that money's going to be there. The question would be is, what's the strength of the project? What's the strength of the regional center? How often do they have denials? And why was the person denied? Was it a project denial? If it's a project denial, you've got more problems right off the bat. That means that the project's probably not a very good project within the USCIS. And so that goes back to, did you do your homework from the very beginning? Look at the track record of this particular regional center. Look at the project itself. It goes back to, again, project structure, as we talked about before. It goes back to the idea of understanding who you're investing with. But in a CMB project, if we have one or two investors that get denied for whatever reason, source of funds or the like, or in case of even if we didn't see it coming, for instance, when the USCIS changed their mind about whether or not gifted funds and how they could be gifted, you know, when they changed their mind on that, for years they were saying it was okay for an individual to have a loan, okay, through a non-family member, and then they restricted that. So there was a lot of regional centers, including CMB, that got caught up in that, where an individual had borrowed the funds, and what was okay before was not okay today. So those
Pat, it is okay. We actually are happy getting approvals when you get gifts from non-family members. That was brought in for the legislation changes, but it hasn't really been implemented yet.
No, but I'm talking about, for instance, we had an investor who had a loan from a third party that was not a family member, and the USCIS denied that and saying that was an impermissible funding. And so that was usually allowed before, but all of a sudden they changed their mind and it was no longer allowed.
Oh, well, that's because USCIS actually wanted to see collateral. They didn't want to just see a random loan, which was uncollateralized. That used to be able to happen, and you can't do that anymore.
Exactly, and that's what I'm getting at. That change was a situation where we didn't anticipate that change coming, and therefore there were a few investors denied, okay, based upon that, and they couldn't raise the funds in any other way, and therefore we had to repay the funds. Well, where were we going to get the money? Well, simply, we have that in our contract about the limited right to withdraw, and we were able to find replacement investors for each one of those individuals because job creation was still occurring. And so that was a simple way to get out. And also, depending on how the documents are written, is it the obligation of the regional center or the new commercial enterprise to pay the person back? If it is, well, you know, there's interest that accrues on a yearly basis, and that interest could be a basis to pay an investor back if there was that. It is the responsibility of the limited partnership to pay that back. Therein lies a problem. In other words, it doesn't really dilute the individual's, holdings in the partnership, because in the end, he has a greater role. If there's 800 investors and five of them get denied, well, you're at 795. But it's 795 people still have the entire amount. And so they're not diluted in the end. So that's okay. I mean, and that makes sense. But again, it's in the details. The devil is in the details on all of these contracts.
Well, I think the devil's also in the numbers. You put a great point once that rules don't change just because retrogression hits. But at the same time, I mean, I've discussed this with many a developer. Sometimes the numbers just don't make sense if you want your money back. And that particular project has paid out huge commissions to third parties. There's just no money there.
Yeah, well, that's something that CMB has never done. You know, we pay commissions, of course, to the third parties, but we don't pay the points that individuals are out there doing. And that causes, I didn't want to get into, that's a whole other subject for us. But here's the point is that, you know, we're talking about trying to get an individual. If an individual just up and says, I want out, they need to understand that that's impossible. I don't know of a regional center that would have that in their documents that would allow a whim to say, hey, I want out. You know, if an investor may demand return or redeem some portion of the capital, okay, it will be deemed to be not at risk. And so, you know, here's the problem too. Let's assume that a regional center is in a situation where an individual is just being obstinate. I want my money back. I want my money back. The problem he has, that regional center has, if they pay that person back, the USCIS could issue an RFE to that regional center and say, why did you pay this person back? Point to me in the documents where you're allowed to pay this person back.
Right.
If that's not in the documents, how are you going to explain it? And then you risk the entire partnership because they could say that there was an impermissible, unspoken redemption agreement in your documents. So that puts every investor at risk, not just the one who wants out. That puts all of them at risk of losing their immigration pursuit because they could claim that there is an impermissible redemption agreement between the partners, but it's not spoken or not written.
Right. And I think that we have heard from almost every regional center that we represent, somebody somewhere, especially from mainland China, has asked to come out. So this is an area that developers are asking us all the time. And we've been quoting this whole thing, but you articulate so well, Pat. I thank you for that. And I hope people who are listening do understand what Pat is trying to get out there and what he's trying to say. You're in, so you're in. Once you're in, you're in.
Yeah, I mean, and the problem you have is few, and I'm just going to go off on a little bit. There are certain markets that the pressure, and certainly the China market is one that has humongous pressure on it, simply because of China was the main market for EB-5. Not so much today. And the reason is because of this retrogression and the long wait. The problem, though, also is people are so desperate. Certain regional centers only marketed in China. So they've lost the China market. And I just caution everyone out there, when there was negotiations back and forth and between, let's say, Senator Grassley's office and Senator Cornyn's office, and it was made somewhat public on what those negotiations said, I can still remember where they were saying, hey, look, there's going to be a set aside for rural areas of like 1,400 visas. I mean, as soon as that came out, people were selling what they called retrogression-free visas in China.
Yeah.
They were selling them. And I was just absolutely taken aback by it.
And I think you were one of the only people who actually really commented and tried to stop it, Pat.
I actually went up to the regional centers at the EB5 conference put on by IIUSA and handed them their documents that were in Chinese and had them translate it and said, why are you doing this? You know it's not the law. And there was even a regional center who was banking on the $100,000 differential between a target employment and a non-target employment. And they were out selling and saying, how can you save $100,000 with us when none of this was law?
Yeah.
And so I know this podcast will go to China, and I want to say this. Don't believe the crap that people are so desperate to sell you. My guy, Kyler James, asked Charlie at the last EB5 immigration seminar.
That's Charlie Oppenheim, the chief of Department of State.
Yeah, and Charlie tells us what the visas are and what the visa availability is. And Kyler James, our chief economist, stood up and said, how long, if an individual from China signed up today, would it be before they could be eligible for a conditional permanent residency? And Charlie said, at least 15 years. All of a sudden, the China market went cold. And why is that? You know, why was it, did it take that clarity for the China market to go cold? It's because there were a lot of people putting together scenarios and stuff that was not true. So let it be known, it's 15 years and it's not anything else. That's coming from the authority. And I had an individual call our offices talking about and comparing himself and his review of other regional centers. And he was saying that someone told him it was 6 years. Well, yeah. Here's the problem. Our guy said, no, it's not. It's probably 15 or more years. And as more people from other countries sign up, there will be less and less visas available because that pool of unused visas gets smaller and smaller. And that was what was driving the Chinese marketplace. As you know, there's only 700 per year allowed. But China was pulling in 8,000, then it moved down to 6,000, then it moved down to 4,000. So we don't know what it is today, but the more the EB5 expands to the rest of the world, the longer that line is going to get.
Yeah, I think, Pat, the people who are quoting 6 years are still under that belief that there's no one else from the rest of the world coming in, and therefore there are lots of unused visas. Because when you start counting all the Indians, Brazilians, South Koreans, and everyone else from all over the world, no, it is going to be more like 15 years. I think that is very much correct.
And what else are they getting wrong?
Well, the thing about it is Charlie is the expert. Charlie is the person who tells us how many visas. He is the one who's authorized. And so this is coming right from the authority. It's not coming from, it's not a guess. It's not a, it's actual facts. And that's what I think people need to understand. The fact is, when you become involved in an EB-5 investment, you're in it. And you have to ride it out until the project pays back, or your investment, if you're an equity, pays back or sells. So the question, and when you talk about the length of time, there is no guesswork anymore. Charlie told us exactly what it is. And back in 2014 and 15, we didn't get the visa bulletins we get today.
That's right.
And so now we can detect and tell exactly to a point, month to month, how long it's going to take. And so no one should be saying these incorrect figures. It should be universal in how long it's going to take. And so what I'm getting at, I'm asking the listeners here to understand, read the documents, understand what you're getting into, and understand that any EB-5 project that you're not irrevocably in is probably going to get you denied.
Agreed.
Well, Patrick Hogan, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice and really talking with us about, honestly, how the money works with EB-5. And I understand it's the regional center's job to raise money and then to create jobs, and then from there to create value, and then to go back and pay investors, both foreign investors and domestic investors. And you have really, well, at least for me, cleared up the vision on why investors can't so much demand their money to be back. As you mentioned, you can't have a right to rescind in there because it wouldn't be at risk and that regional center would never be approved. Conversely, if they were approved and they just gave investors money back anyway, they're putting everybody else at risk. So to help one person, they basically hurt all their other investors, whether they're looking for, immigration return or financial return or a mix of both. And, lastly, I hope there is some amount of legislative changes because, as you mentioned, that 15-year benchmark that Charlie Oppenheim came out and said, you know, one way that could fix that, obviously, is increase the number of visas or perhaps count them differently, such as 10,000 visas. Maybe that should actually be for investors and not families. But again, I ramble on. But Patrick Hogan, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Mona. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. And I thank you very much for getting out the word to all the potential investors and the investors in EB5, as you know, the truth needs to be put out for everybody to hear.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.